Maybe it's just that you don't know how to use social courtesy.
Oh, that's old-fashioned.
Watch how
Lizzie Post
and Dan Post-Senate
act as host and hostess. They know that courtesy means showing respect, thinking of the other person, real friendliness.
Hello.
And welcome to Awesome Etiquette,
where we explore modern etiquette through the lens of consideration, respect, and honesty.
On today's show, we take your questions on guests who are gluten-free, asking others what they do for work, inviting almost everyone to a gathering, and tipping for an appliance delivery.
For Awesome Etiquette community members, our question of the week is about difficult apologies.
Plus your most excellent feedback, etiquette salute, and a postscript on how we use consideration, respect, and honesty to answer etiquette questions.
All that's coming up. Awesome Etiquette comes to you from the studios of our home offices in Vermont and is proud to be produced by the Emily Post Institute. I'm Dan Post-Senning.
And I'm Lizzie Post. Hey, Dan.
How's it going?
It's going well. I mean, mostly we've had very sunny days, brisk days, but sunny days. And I just think that makes spring so nice.
It really is. As long as you don't get seduced by that sunshine and wear too little heading out your door
yes.
in the morning.
I had to go put on an extra pair of leggings today. It was still in the 40s when I took the dogs out. But it's warming up. And I got to say, as much as I like working inside on a rainy day, it is also very nice to work and feel the sunshine. And so it's feeling good. You had an interesting show note for our intro. You want to talk about dancing with trees?
Well, it fits in well with your sunny days, brisk sunny days. These are the perfect days for working outside. And
it's true.
It's not.
And you don't
and
mean
sweaty.
Bringing your computer out. You mean like doing yard work and stuff, right?
That is a good clarification. That is exactly what I am talking about. And no bugs, no sweat, just the call of the wild and all of the debris and clutter from winter on your lawn and in your hedges. And it's just a perfect time to grab the kids after an early pickup at school and spend the early part of the evening knocking around outside. And the dancing with the trees is I am so sore. I've been doing so much yard work, whether it's power raking the dirt that the plow pushes up onto the lawn off of it,
mm-hmm.
or sawing up the giant limbs that have fallen out of trees and are now around, or any of the number of tasks that make the place look good for spring and summer, but leave you a little worn out when you're used to spending long days inside curled up by the fire.
Yeah.
It's reminding me of my days as a professional dancer, my days in my 20s when I did physical theater and dance. And I always knew things were good when I was the right kind of sore, when my body was tired and a little achy, but it was the good kind of ache that means you're getting stronger. And I'm feeling that these days. So my theme is I'm dancing with the trees and I'm loving this tired, sore feeling that I'm waking up with every morning.
Audience, don't you just want to smack him sometimes? I'm just kidding. We're not going to use that.
No, Chris, please leave it in because I feel like I deserve it. And every once in a while, I give myself a little slap.
Again, violence, never fun, not a good thing to joke about. But gosh darn it, Dan, if you don't paint such an idealistic life and then even tell us that you embrace sore muscles.
Well, the other story I could have told was getting trapped at t-ball practice yesterday, and it was the first day I hadn't wore long underwear under my shirt, and I was freezing cold. And usually I'm the one who kind of lingers. I want to chat with everybody and let the kids
You're
play
like, Niche,
afterwards.
Let's go.
Come on. Let's get in the car.
I got the heat running. What?
Oh, it was miserable.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm glad you're having fun dancing with the trees and doing all this stuff. I'm feeling just a little bit sore. It's good. I definitely get what you mean. It's nice to also just feel yourself kind of unfold from the winter. I don't know. For those that maybe don't have as much of like a hibernation during the winter as Dan and I do, might not bring the same feeling.
I keep telling my girls, these are the best days of the year. The days are long and still getting longer.
Yay! Well, cousin, what I don't think we want to get terribly long, despite the days are getting longer, is this intro. Do you think it's time that we should get to some questions?
I do. Let's do it.
Awesome Etiquette is here to answer your questions. You can email them to awesomeetiquette@emilypost.com. Leave a voicemail or text at 802-858-KIND. That's 802-858-5463. Or you can reach us online. On Substack, you can post a comment to our Monday podcast post. On Instagram, we are at Emily Post Institute. And on Facebook, we are The Emily Post Institute. With any social media post, just remember to use the hashtag Awesome Etiquette so that we know you want your question on the show. Awesome Etiquette gets support from Storyworth. There are some stories about your mom's life that you truly never get tired of hearing. From hilarious to heartfelt, tear-jerking to plot-twisting, mom's retelling of the events always brings a bit of joy. Just in time for Mother's Day, we here at Awesome Etiquette found the perfect gift that can capture all of your mom's stories for your family forever. It's called Storyworth. Storyworth helps you preserve precious memories and stories from your mom or a mother figure in your life for years to come. Here's how it works. Each week, Storyworth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick. What was your first job? Who was your first crush? Storyworth makes the writing process a breeze. All your loved one needs to do is to respond to the email prompt with a story. Long or short, it doesn't matter. I did this with my mom and it was really, really rewarding. You'll be emailed a copy of your loved one's responses as they're submitted over the course of the year. You'll get to enjoy their retelling of the stories, some you probably already know, or maybe the ones that you're surprised by you haven't heard before. After that year of fun discovery and reminiscing, Storyworth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book that you'll be able to share and revisit for generations to come. You can even keep a copy of the book for yourself. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift that you all will cherish for years. Storyworth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/manners. That's Storyworth, Storyworth.com/manners. It's manners with an S, to save $10 on your first purchase. And now, back to our show.
Our first question this week is about a gluten-free guest. Dear Lizzie and Dan, a friend of mine is coming down to stay with my husband and me for several days. Usually hosting one person, even for several days, would not be cause for concern. But this friend happens to have celiac disease, and therefore all gluten is off limits. When my friend inquired about coming down to visit, I offered suggestions for local restaurants which are celiac-friendly, and also asked if she had a list of recipes or food items she could send me so I could take her grocery shopping upon arrival. She declined to do so, and said she preferred to stick to whole foods, such as fruit, vegetables, rice, etc., instead of having us buy specialty gluten-free items. To be clear, I was not offering to purchase these items, but wanted to know in advance so I could figure out which stores carry what she likes. This does not leave me feeling very confident about meals, and also frustrated, as it sounds like she expects us to handle the cooking. Is there another way I can broach the subject again before her visit? I want to ensure she has access to foods she can safely enjoy, but I also don't think it's fair that we, who don't have allergies, are left to guess at what she can eat. Thanks in advance for your suggestions on how to handle this food-sensitive situation. Sincerely, Gluten-Free Guest.
Gluten-free host of a gluten-free guest. I can understand why this seems a little bit frustrating or confusing. Dan, when I heard you read it and when I first read this question, I'll be honest, I was a little curious about the dynamic of having asked for recipes or food items that this person would like, which are celiac friendly, so that I could take her grocery shopping upon arrival. If the goal was to take her shopping so that she had the food she might need, I think rather than ask her for recipes and items, I would probably just ask her, hey, when you get into town, would you like to, you know, go food shopping so that you've got stuff in the house that's, you know, gluten-free and you know you can trust it and feel good about it. I might have offered something like that. And even if a decline came, what I'm getting a sense of here from the responses from the guest is that I think the guest is trying to not make a very big deal about the allergy and kind of lean towards the idea that there's a lot of common stuff that we all eat that'll be totally fine. You don't have to go special for me on this. Like, I think she's almost hearing you try to accommodate and trying to relieve you of that burden if she needs to, and just saying, this is actually more simple than it seems. You know, we can just do veggies and rice, and I don't know if proteins were in that too, but that's what I'm getting from this. So I'm not sure that I'm thinking that the guest is expecting a whole lot, actually. What's your take, Dan? I'm just curious.
I definitely am feeling the trickiness of this situation because It's an overlap of several etiquette issues. There's that host-guest dance. There's the safety question, maybe pushing you to want to know with more certainty about some things than if it was purely preferential, you might not worry about it quite so much. And even someone's diet. We know that that can be something that some people are really eager and interested in sharing and wanting to be sure is discussed and taken care of, and other people feel more private about. But like you, my general read was that this guest is making an effort to try to minimize their impact, which in some ways is a good guest move. But in this particular case, it's a little, it's feeling like a stepping on toes, like there's not enough information being given. And put me in the camp of, more communication is better. If there's some confusion, if there's some misunderstanding, if one person's intending to be low impact, but the way that's being received is it's forcing me to think more about it, make more choices, prepare for more eventualities. Rather than say the dance is over, maybe it's time to, I don't want to say get a little closer, but maybe clarify the steps or the tune. And I don't think it's awkward or difficult or problematic to reach out again and say, hey, I'm trying to get my ducks in a row for your visit. Appreciate your thoughts on not needing special foods or a special shopping trip, but was hoping maybe we could talk about food for the week or planning some recipes or planning some meals.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Just, and even to say, just so that I make sure that I'm planning stuff you really can eat and enjoy. Dan, what do you think about the nature that typically when we're hosting someone for a weekend or they're coming to stay at our house that, as the host, we are usually preparing to take on, you know, the bulk of supplying the meals and the space and all those sorts of things that we typically do as hosts. It sounds like maybe this friendship, it's a little like I'm hearing the, where's the responsibility? Do we have to be responsible for someone else's diet? And I'm coming down, I'm feeling my natural inclination is to come down on the side of you do a little bit. You're inviting the person to come stay for the whole weekend, making sure that they can participate in the meals, or fessing up and saying, I'm really nervous about cross-contamination and I would love to structure this so that I know you're taking care of your meals and feeling good about that. But even that starts to sound not hospitable. Like, you know what I mean? But there is that moment of kind of like, I think as a host, you do want to be taking care of these things. And there are lots of gluten-free dishes that work for everybody. So I feel like even the celiac doesn't come in so much as a barrier. I think the cross-contamination could be the place where it becomes a higher level accommodation because you are trying to make sure pans haven't been used and servingware hasn't been used and that sort of stuff. With gluten items.
I could hear your concern that maybe what you were suggesting sounded inhospitable, but I want you to know it didn't sound inhospitable to me. In fact, in some ways it sounds very hospitable that you are taking on that responsibility of being sure that there is food and that there's food that people can eat. And like you, I think that broadly as a host, when you're talking about someone staying with you, I think about meals, particularly meals that happen in the home, being part of the host responsibility. They don't have to be. You could, as a guest, offer to take on some of that responsibility, maybe do some grocery shopping, maybe do some meal planning. I would not assume any of those things as a guest. I would offer them. And I think that in some ways it's quite hospitable if you're thinking to yourself, boy, I want to be prepared for that, but I also want to be sure we have some fruits around. So there is a snack that my guest can grab. And I'm thinking about that as something I want to do as a host.
Right.
There was some information provided. Fruits are good. Vegetables are good. There are a lot of choices when it comes to fruit, and maybe not something that's got gluten in it, but maybe something that is something someone would prefer to the fruit that would be just as easy to pick up that's sitting next to it at the supermarket. And I think that if you can keep a tone of annoyance or frustration out of that conversation, yes, where you ask for a little more information, that it could actually come across sounding very hospitable and very much like you're making an effort to take care of someone, thinking ahead and planning. We talk on this show all the time about how safety supersedes etiquette. And when you're talking about someone who has celiac disease, that is not a gluten-free preference. That is not a,
right,
a diet where someone has choice about it. There are real health implications if there is gluten in that diet. And I'm sure that person is well aware of this and knows to take care of themselves and take care with what they eat. But you as a host are just getting used to that. And I don't think it's necessarily awkward to ask for a little bit more information, as long as you context it with the person as coming from a place of real care for them and really wanting to, I don't want to say go the extra mile, but be sure your bases are covered so that you can, yes, really count on enjoying your time with them and even alleviate some of your own worries and preparation ahead of time. And I think taking some of that responsibility and being specific about what it is that you're looking for and why makes that a very reasonable follow-up request.
Host of a gluten-free guest, we greatly appreciate you sending in this question. We know that there are other folks who have this very same problem or issue or question arise as they plan for what should be a really, really fun weekend with a friend visiting from out of town. We certainly hope that our suggestions and our sample scripts help you to navigate this well. At the end of the day, picking up that phone, getting in touch, and keeping your tone friendly and with that air of hospitality, we think will serve you very well.
People like to come together at mealtimes. They enjoy each other's company while they're enjoying good food. Mealtime is fun for Frank. And it's fun for Judy, too. But it's different with Ralph.
Our next question is titled, Work Question Woes. Hi, Awesome Etiquette Team. I was hoping for your help navigating a recurrent awkward situation related to work inquiries in casual conversation. I have two elementary school-aged kids and often run into parents, typically female, of other children at playdates, birthdays, sports, etc. Often the other parents and I make small talk. I'm a physician, and most of the other parents know this as it comes up from my children frequently, usually in the context of why I'm usually absent from daytime school events. In parentheses, there's a sigh notation here. During the course of these small talk conversations, the other parents will ask me about many aspects of my work. I'd like to reciprocate and ask the other parents about their lives too, so it's not all about me. The trouble is that I don't know if the other parent works outside the home, and I feel awkward asking, so what do you do? Or something similar. I don't want to come across as condescending in any way, so I often try to end the conversation or switch subjects to avoid this awkwardness. However, I genuinely want to know about the other parents and get to know them better. I fear that either way, I may be coming across as rude. What's a good way to ask someone what they do without inflicting shame, as there is none, if their job is to take care of their kids? I've tried, how do you spend your days? But that also doesn't feel right. Was hoping you could help prevent me from insulting anyone and to reduce any future awkwardness in these social events. Also, apologize if this question was addressed previously. Sincerely, Awkward Doctor. I don't know why I really like the sign-off of Awkward Doctor.
Probably because we all know an awkward doctor, and it's kind of fun.
It is. It is.
Well, hopefully this answer will help our question asker feel a little less awkward in this moment. And this is a version of a question we have addressed on this show before, and it falls under the broader category of conversation killers. And when someone just always asks, what do you do, as a way to start a conversation with someone new, it can work well for some people, but for other people, it is an absolute conversation killer. And we've acknowledged that it walks up to that line of potentially asking someone how they make money or in some contexts, there can be an implication that you're sorting people based on what the answer might be. That's one of the reasons that question is considered socially awkward broadly in Europe, as opposed to the States, where it's pretty common for people to ask each other that, as sort of mundane as it feels to me at times.
Yeah, yeah.
You, Lizzie Post, have some great sample scripts for this. And I wanted to acknowledge the broader umbrella that this falls under, but then ask you for a couple of those sample scripts, because I think that they would be really effective in this situation.
Well, like you, Dan, I think there are some places where this conversation can be really welcomed and interesting. But when you don't know, you don't know, right? Hard telling, not knowing. And so I think it's really important to recognize that always with this question. But I do think that questions like how do you spend your time, or, you know, what are you interested in these days? They're great questions. And yet I also really sympathize with awkward doctor, that when someone's just asked you about your professional life and you turn around and say, how do you spend your days? I don't want to say there's a disconnect, because if not, we can change conversation anytime when we're talking with folks, right? We can change the direction of a conversation. But at the same time, there is this lack of reciprocity, maybe, that could be what awkward doctor is feeling in trying to ask about someone's time in a more broad way. And I think awkward doctor's at a slightly unfair disadvantage, because their profession is already known. And that's, I can understand how that makes them kind of primed and ready to talk about their profession openly, whereas the other parent that they're talking to hasn't had that kind of community exposure. One of the things, and this doesn't quite address the question, Dan, so I apologize for taking us off in a little bit of a tangent, but one of the things that I wish for, remember when we talked about the etiquette magic wand? Like, if you had your etiquette magic wand, I would give everyone the confidence, whether your answer is, live off an inheritance, or whether I stay at home with my kids and am the homemaker in that role, or whatever it is you do that might not seem like a traditional job, quote unquote. I would love us all to have the confidence when someone says, what do you do, in saying, I'm a homemaker, and that's not any kind of lesser thing, or that you would somehow embarrass someone by them having to give that answer. I don't like the idea that somehow there's an embarrassment around the answers that aren't traditional jobs. And at the same time, we hear from audience members who are in this position how much they don't like the question. So again, I come back to the issue of there is an etiquette problem with the question, and I do want to solve that. But there is this rallying cry I have, Dan, of let's all just be really proud of whatever situation you're in and feel confident saying that. And then let's not invite too many questions afterwards. But to deal with it in this moment, I like the idea of going for, you know, how do you like to spend your time? I'm curious, Dan, what do you think about the vagueness of this one? How about you? You're not technically asking, how about you, what do you do? You're not filling in the specific. But I'm wondering if just a how about you is enough to turn the conversation towards someone and let them volunteer, or if it's just too vague and this is a wah-wah of a sample script idea.
I think it could work, although if someone's asking about aspects of what you do, I think that obviously doesn't work. And if you don't answer the question that they ask, if you just turn it immediately around on them, I think even with a light tone, I think substantively it could feel a little combative or off-putting. And
I could hear that.
It might be the direction you want to go. You want to let someone know that question wasn't appreciated, but if they want to answer it themselves, they'd be welcome to.
You've reminded me that one of the dynamics that might be going on around here too is, like you said, they're asking sort of more questions about that work, that physician work that they know is going on. And the how about you, you're right, it wouldn't really work going the other way if the conversation has developed for a minute or two around the doctor's job and what that entails. Okay, so not a good tactic. Not a good tactic, Lizzie.
I was thinking of the versions of your sample script that aren't as passive as how do you like to spend your time, but
sure,
what are you interested in these days, or something that directs them to not just how does your day pass, but what are you enjoying right now, or how do you like to spend your time, or what are you interested in? And it could be, oh, I really don't have time for much. I don't have energy for much besides my kids and my job right now. Might be the answer. That's the boring answer I find myself giving most of the time these days.
But although, I might ask, oh, what do you do? Because you've mentioned your job now.
Opened that door. I have. The particular advice that I think might help our awkward doctor in this moment are two things. One is, I think there's a certain generosity in being willing to share a little bit, that it is a pretty common question in America, what do you do? And one of the pieces of advice we like to give is, have a version of your answer for that in your pocket that you're okay with. Yeah. You and I have talked about it on this show. Sometimes we don't want to talk about everything that we do, but you just, you reply to the question because there's a certain decency in that. Someone is curious, they've asked, and it's rude to point out that they're being potentially rude, prying.
Yeah, exactly.
and I don't really feel like it's embargoed information. It's not the thing I most want to talk about, but it's certainly nothing secret or nothing that I need to hide. So I have versions of that answer that I'm comfortable giving, but then I can also pivot off that and ask a different kind of question. And being ready with your pivot, I think when you're meeting kids and their parents, you have a very, with your children at shared activities like this, your pivot is so easy and available to you. It's the kids, it's what they're doing, how they know each other. In my case, whether you've seen these other parents before and can remember or not, because it's really difficult. There are a lot of people coming and going from your and your kids' lives. So that's one approach that you can take. Have that answer ready and also be ready with your pivot. The other piece of advice that I was thinking about is that it shows self-awareness if you're keen to the fact that a conversation is mostly about you. And having some little markers or some other turns that you can use in a conversation to bring the topic of conversation to a general shared topic or to someone else who's participating is a really good idea. And it's another version of this conversation that can get awkward. But when you start to dominate either in terms of what you're talking about or the fact that it's you or your interests that are the only thing that's being talked about, I think you can even acknowledge that, say, and I do that all day. What I'm really curious about is how you're getting little Jimmy to bed at night, or you don't want to ask specific questions about kids,
about parenting,
but
hard,
something
right?
else that you could turn to that isn't just you, but is a shared interest or curiosity.
I was thinking, Dan, is there anything you could ask them about? Much like they're asking you things that they have learned about you from your kids talking about it, maybe to their kids or even to them directly, maybe at a play date or something like that. I'm wondering if there isn't something you can use from the general knowledge, you know, of your kid and these kids either being on the same team or having play dates and things like that, that allows you to ask the parents something about them. Maybe it's not a job, but, oh, you know, Jimmy mentioned that you guys were gone last weekend to your grandmother's. Did you have a nice trip? You know, something like that. And I know that's like a, yeah, great if your kid and their kid have talked about things and you've now been privy to them. But I'm always impressed, Dan, with how much you know about what Nisha's friends are up to and stuff. And I'm just wondering if there's something in that vein to reach for to get the conversation moving to the other parent, maybe not what they do, but how they are spending their family time or something like that.
The recital is next week. The first game is in 2 weeks. The practice is going to switch its pickup schedule. There are oftentimes things about that shared activity that can be the next topic of conversation.
Yeah.
I found myself last night introducing myself to a parent, and I, without thinking, found myself asking if their child went to the same daycare as my child. And then almost, I didn't apologize for asking, but felt as soon as I had asked it, again, I was asking questions about someone else's kid, that I owed them an explanation. I said, you know, sometimes they know each other already. I'm just wondering if they know each other, because they sure seemed like they did. They ran up to each other and started playing together. They did not. But it was a natural question to ask based on the way the kids were interacting in that moment.
Totally.
And provided the jumping off point for the conversation with the new mom I met. Hi, Ariana. So there definitely are versions of that question about the kids that I think are fair game in those situations and are a natural place to turn to in those moments. Awkward Doctor, thank you for such a specific question. And thank you for giving us a chance to talk about something that we know is of interest to other people, but in a slightly different context. We certainly hope that our answer helps you feel less awkward in these situations in the future.
Well, that's the end of our story. A happy ending, too, because Steve Hull finally did face up to both sides of his problem, the physical and the emotional alike. You see, that's what it takes to win the fight against an ulcer at work.
Our next question is about an invite issue. Mm. Hello, Lizzie. Hello, Daniel. I'm living abroad, and I built a group of friends who are the same heritage as I am, which makes me feel a bit more at home. And I love it. I am the only one in the group living in a big house with a great garden, and I would like to invite my friends now that the good weather approaches. Nevertheless, one of the persons in the group behaved very badly with me. I don't want her as a close friend. And I don't want uncomfortable situations in the group either. This is why I asked several times to meet and discuss things, but she keeps avoiding it. I don't want someone in my house that doesn't talk to me and that makes me feel uncomfortable. How can I invite all the others without having her home? It seems rude to invite the whole group individually without telling anything to her. I really wouldn't mind her coming once in a while if we could have a talk and clear things up. But I won't keep insisting to someone that doesn't seem to care. Thank you very much for your help and recommendations. All the best. A big fan of Awesome Etiquette.
Dan, I feel like my answer to this question is going to feel very not etiquette-y. But truthfully, what I am hearing here is there's been some kind of offense or rift between these two individuals, and that our future host, we'll call them, a big fan of Awesome Etiquette, has reached out numerous times to try to clear the air, get on the same page, you know, make amends between each other, whatever the issue is. And we don't know what the issue is, so we don't know why the other person is resisting. But what I come down to automatically is you've made the effort to try to repair what seems to be a damaged relationship, or at least create space to repair it. And the other person is not stepping up to meet you. To me, that means there's very little social obligation for you to include them in things that are completely your decision. If this was a group, like, let's say you were all practicing speaking the language of the country that you've all resettled in or are staying and living in right now, especially if this was a group you paid money to be a part of, I think that's something else. Those group meetings, then it's a shame that the two of you can't come together on things, but you've got to both participate in this thing. We're talking about a social engagement at your home. I do not think there's any obligation to invite this person. If I had a social group where one person and I had, like, let's say in my group of golf girls, that one of them and I had a big rift and I had tried to connect with them to either apologize or to, like you say, clear the air, and that was met with nothing, I think that that's a indication from the other person that they are not willing to engage you, and they're probably not going to be inviting you to things, you know? That moment of we've tried, or I've tried, and you haven't stepped up to join me in this space of reconciliation or moving forward, indicates that you have no social obligation to invite this person, even if they are a part of a tight group. And I think, frankly, the person themselves would know why they weren't being invited. Like, I know why I don't get invited to certain things if the person doesn't like me. You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing for the host to be worrying about that. I'm like, no, we had beef. I know. I don't have people like this in my life, really, but I think that it's a reality at times. And so my vote is just don't invite them and keep moving forward until they finally talk with you about this, if that's the way it's going.
I don't think that's an unetiquette-y answer. I think that's the etiquette foundation for this answer. Because I couldn't agree anymore, Lizzie Post.
Oh,
if someone
good.
Is awkward, if they give you the silent treatment, I think that's one of the, frankly, I think that's one of the worst things that people can do to each other.
I agree.
Ignoring someone, silent treatmenting them.
It's, the cut direct, as Emily called it.
It is so awkward and it's so uncomfortable. And if you're talking about social engagements and places where you're clearly the host, inviting people to your home. Absolutely. There's no obligation to invite someone who behaves badly, makes you feel uncomfortable, and who you have a difficult history with. I really liked the way you identified as part of that, that this isn't a group that is organized in some other faction, that it's right. not a group where the hosting duties are shared. Maybe there's several people that issue the invitation or make the reservation. I can think of other types of group get-togethers, book clubs that you don't pay to be a part of, but that the group is defined because there are multiple hosts.
Right. Yeah.
I really keyed on the language here. I built a group of friends that yep. it really sounds like it's your hosting role that has brought this group together, at least in this context. And like you, Lizzie, I think that having done that work of trying to work it out, of offering opportunities repeatedly to try to clear the air, as you put it, are the other etiquette foundation or the lay the groundwork for making that decision very comfortably about whether or not you invite someone. Mm-hmm. Having said all that, I want to lay a layer of etiquette subtlety on top of it.
Sure.
I do think that excluding people particularly can be a version of that silent treatment, that it can feel really
yes.
painful.
Yes.
To be excluded, to be isolated in a certain way, to feel like other people have grouped up and excluded you. It's one of the feelings that people get about etiquette when they think about it in negative terms, that there are in groups and out groups, people that fit and people that don't. And if you are concerned just about creating that impression, if that's something that you that would make you feel awkward, not something that is wrong because you're the host and you get to choose, but that this group had enough cohesion that it would feel strange to you to invite everyone from that group, but not one person, whatever the reason.
Yeah.
That you could do a staged approach. I could see getting together with subgroups or people within that group
yeah.
first. Maybe it's that you don't invite everyone and not her, but you invite three people to a tea. And mm-hmm. maybe you invite eight to a luncheon, or maybe you invite a couple to come do some gardening with you. Mm-hmm. But you start to break up
the
cohesion
group a little bit.
of that group in a way that maybe at some point, maybe a couple visits down the line, everyone except the person who you have a difficult time with could be a part of it. And it wouldn't feel like such an immediate exclusion.
It wouldn't
be such a glaring omission.
No, I really, really like that. I also think that one thing that is worth the effort is to take a moment and, again, we don't know the situation that's going on between these two individuals, but to take a moment and ask yourself, have my invitations to reconcile or to talk things out been the right tone? You know, have I reached out in a way that is inviting and not combative or forceful? And I think that sometimes the very same call to come together can be met with very different reactions with just a few little tweaks. And we don't know how these outreaches have gone. And so we can't really speculate on like, oh, you should do this or this or this instead. I think it's important anytime you might be moving towards the action of like, I'm not going to invite someone to everything anymore, or I'm not even going to invite them anymore. And even if you're implementing a more subtle strategy like the one that Dan laid out that I really like, it's worth just taking that second and saying, how might my outreach have been perceived by the other person? And is there anything I could do to make one more effort or another effort that might result in them wanting to talk or get together about this? And I might just give myself that chance and that moment for self-reflection. Dan, I really like your approach. I think it's a good one for this. And I think that it could help soften a blow or not make it such an explicit exiling of a person or exclusion of a person, excuse me.
Well, I also really like the sincerity and the honesty in taking a look at how your attempts at reconciliation have gone. And there was a piece of concluding advice that I think dovetails onto that, which is,
okay,
I think if you're going that route of saying, listen, I'm not going to invite this person to be part of something that they've been a part of, that you also stay open to the possibility of reconciliation. That maybe as time goes on and someone realizes, wait a minute, not following up with that person might have cost me some of the social opportunities or even just some of the social connection that I found so valuable. And I would like to take them up on that offer to get together and sort things out or say what needs to be said or whatever it might be, that you don't think of that opportunity as being closed, but that you stay open to that possibility. And I think that would also help me feel good about then making the decision to control what I can control in the meantime and keep the atmosphere and experience at my home one that I feel genuinely good about. A big fan of awesome etiquette, we are a big fan of this question, and we really hope that our answer helps and that this group continues to function for you in all the ways that you have enjoyed it working while you're abroad.
Another very important question you must ask yourself concerns your character. You will probably agree that honesty and loyalty are two of the strongest points of character. Are you honest with yourself? Are you honest with others? Are you loyal?
Our next question is titled Appliance Appreciation. Hi, how are you? Dan, how are you today?
I'm well.
I'm well too. Thanks for asking. I'm getting a delivery of an appliance from a store. Should I, and how much should I tip? Thank you, Wayne. Great question.
It is a great question. Instant etiquette pop quiz. Lizzie Post, how much do you tip for a dishwasher delivery?
It depends. It depends. Some services you tip for, others you don't. Sometimes it's discretionary. I offered a $20 tip to the two, so it would have been $10 each to the gentleman who dropped off my big sleeper sofa about 7 years ago when I bought it. And they were like dumbfounded and were like, well, we don't typically accept tips. And I was like, well, I mean, if you want it. And they were like, yeah, no, that actually would be nice. Like it was, but it was one of those moments where they were like, yeah, that doesn't usually happen. And other times I know that there's varying degrees on how far an appliance is brought into your house. Sometimes you are automatically charged a service fee for this. That fee is not a tip, but it's the type of stuff that I might weigh in. And I'm not saying I would come down on any particular side, but I think it's a nice thing to offer. Don't be surprised if it gets refused. I think somewhere in the range of like something lighter, $5 maybe, heavier in the 10 to 20 range, depending on how many people are doing it. Those would just be some of the factors I would be thinking about. Movers is a different thing from appliance delivery, just as a heads up.
Good point. I like the general reminder that tipping is discretionary. It is up to you. This isn't sit down service. But having said that, thinking about appliance delivery, I'm usually ready for about a $20 tip. And I'm thinking about that like you are, that I think there's a very good chance someone's probably going to help you get that appliance somewhere, maybe into your house, maybe into the spot, whether there's an installation involved or not starts mm-hmm. to bring up another question. But mm-hmm. unless the truck pulls up and it's just, you know, brought down with a lift and left on the sidewalk, in which case I don't feel so compelled to offer the tip. Mm-hmm. If someone's helping me move an appliance, I'm probably going to feel better about it if I've got $20 to offer. And mm-hmm. like you say, I don't think it has to be that. You could, if you got 10, you could offer them 10. If mm-hmm. it was an easy delivery, it could be a little less. But like you, I'm also used to people maybe not in my area expecting that tip. So I've also got some language in mind where I want to remind anyone offering a tip like this, don't forget to thank them when you deliver it. Mm-hmm. Hey, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Can't wait to not be doing dishes by hand, and you help make that happen. And I'll oftentimes say something that one of my favorite people to tip is the AAA guy that helps us get cars out of ditches on our road, which happens a couple of times a winter. There aren't a lot of tow services in the area, so I've actually gotten used to the on-call people from the nearest AAA tow services. Mm-hmm. And until they got used to me being a tipper, and now it's kind of funny because I know I'm sort of a well-liked client.
Yeah.
It always caught people by surprise. And I would say something like, hey, I'm so glad you could make it out at this time of night. Treat yourself to a coffee or something. I know it's not much, but, you know, maybe you get a hot coffee on the way back down or something. And sort of a little encouragement that this is just for you to enjoy. And I really appreciate it. Yeah. I think can go a long way to helping someone feel that gratitude and receive it well.
Like you with the guys who were dropping off the couch. the first slight refusal and blushing, I was like, I don't know, it'd be like, get yourself a sandwich for lunch or something, or you know, like do something light with it, and that got him. That was the thing that led to the acceptance.
Wait, I am going
to
be stopping for lunch later today, and yes, this would help
you know,
with that.
That's really thoughtful. Thanks a lot. Like, it was just that little bit of extra encouragement that got him to take it. Whereas when I was, and I know this isn't a delivery situation, but when I worked retail down at Michael Kehoe's, I was often offered cash tip for just having helped someone do some shopping for the day. And I refused every single one, never took it, always said, you know, I'm paid well enough, which I mean, like, a debatable statement right there. But
well, this is my job. I think of this as part of my job.
Like, this is, well, and my job isn't a job where tips are accepted. So I don't take them even when they're offered, you know. And I think that's, you know, worth recognizing if someone's really turning you down and they're saying, no, this is a part of the service that you have paid for and I am compensated. Like, don't worry about it. And you might get that answer, and I would respect that answer if I got it. Wayne, we certainly hope that this new appliance is going to be a very exciting addition to your home, and we hope that our answer helps you decide if and how much to tip.
Thank you for your questions. Please send us updates or feedback on our answers to awesomeetiquette@emilypost.com. You can leave us a voicemail or text at 802-858-KIND. That's 802-858-5463. Or reach us online. On Substack, you can post a comment to our Monday podcast post. On Instagram, we are at Emily Post Institute. And on Facebook, we are The Emily Post Institute. Just remember, use the hashtag AwesomeEtiquette with your post, feedback, or question so that we know you want it on the show.
If you enjoy Awesome Etiquette, consider becoming a subscriber to our Substack by going to emilypost.substack.com. You'll get weekly content like our podcast, etiquette articles, and the inspirational Saturday Sip delivered straight to your inbox. Whether you choose the free or community member paid subscription, this is the very best way to keep the etiquette conversation going and stay up to date on all things Emily Post. And to those of you who are already with us on Substack, thank you so much for your support.
It's time for our feedback segment, where we hear from you about the questions we answer and the topics we cover. Today we have feedback from Sarah about episode 414 and hosting tiny house guests.
Dear Lizzie and Dan, thank you for taking the time to answer the question I posed to you way back in episode 414 about hosting tiny house guests. Since I wrote in, my husband and I have hosted my almost 2-year-old niece, along with her parents, my sister and brother-in-law. Their visit was a delight, thanks to your helpful tips. We spoke with my sister and her husband ahead of time to identify potential hazards in our home, as well as suggested a local rental company so that they could obtain basic baby equipment for the duration of their stay. My sister and brother-in-law joke that they are the first parents in history who have taken a toddler to Walt Disney World and returned home feeling rested. Thanks again for your tips, which really helped to make their visit enjoyable for all. Sincerely, host of Tiny House Guests. Woo-hoo. I don't know why the Tiny House Guest thing cracked me up, but it just does. That's wonderful. Host of Tiny House Guests. We're so glad that the advice was helpful, and more so really glad that you all got that quality family time together.
Bravo on the hosting job, and look out, I sense more visits coming in the future.
Thank you for sending us your thoughts and updates. Please do keep them coming. You can send your feedback or update to awesomeetiquette@emilypost.com or leave us a voicemail or text at 802-858-KIND. That's 802-858-5463. It's time for our postscript segment, where we dive deeper into a topic of etiquette, and today we're going to look at how we apply consideration, respect, and honesty in our problem solving for the questions that you hear on this show. This is kind of like a expose the magic, maybe? I feel like pull back the curtain. What lever is Oz pulling? I don't know. What do you think?
I was going to say, are we Oz in this situation?
I can't tell. But But this is how we do it. This is how we do it. And Dan, I am so glad that you wanted to do this postscript because we haven't done it in a little while. And as you had reminded me, there's a lot of folks who don't go back and listen to the show in order. And so they haven't built up those conversations about CRH if they're just dropping in from episode, you know, 451 or something like that. And I just love that inclusive spirit. Get everybody on the same page. And this is such solid etiquette conversation here. I really love it. Fundamental stuff.
Well, and it feels so fundamental to you and to me and to a lot of people that have been listening to this show since the beginning that I think sometimes we take it for granted that yes. there is an underlying foundation and process that we lean on when we think about how to answer etiquette problems that are situational, where there's not a particular rule or manner or guideline that we can point to provide an answer. And the problem-solving process that we've used and we outlined on the very first couple episodes of this show has stayed remarkably consistent. And it's been consistent for the Post family for a couple generations now. Mm-hmm. And it's been consistent and has served this show very well for almost 10 years now.
Yeah.
So the origins of the problem-solving process that we use are the principles that we identified at the Emily Post Institute as being fundamental to good etiquette: consideration, respect, and honesty. Those are ideally the values that are being expressed or displayed or exhibited through the behaviors that we often call and think of as manners on this show. So they're a fundamental part of the etiquette equation. What we're hoping to show people with our respectful, polite, well-mannered behavior is that we value things like consideration, respect, and honesty. So how do we apply those things when there isn't a particular manner that is a shorthand or a code that people can understand in a certain context to be exhibiting those things? What happens when you're trying to figure out what to do and you know you want to be considerate, respectful, and honest? Mm-hmm. But you want to apply that and you want to show that to somebody or make that part of your approach and your decision making to the situation at hand. Lizzie, do you want to get us started with consideration? How do you get consideration working? How do you start to apply it?
Audience, just so you know, I'm giggling over here because I feel very much so like, A, the one or two times Dan and I have ever taught our business etiquette seminars together, like this just, I got major memory vibes from like our session at VPR. But I'm also just delighted because I also feel a little bit like an audience member getting to sit and listen to you talk about some of this. Y'all have to understand, Dan is an amazing presenter of this material, whether he's working one-on-one with our business etiquette trainers online, or whether he is teaching up on stage or in a virtual setting. He's a very good presenter and storyteller. I have to say, cousin, it was delightful to just kind of sit there for a second and listen to you really go through material that you are very, very familiar with. And I would love to start us off, by the way. This is the five-step process, really. We have sort of two versions of it that we talk about. Sometimes we talk about this in terms of being three goals, but the five steps, I think our podcast audience who have heard it before will understand why we're going to lean into this method today, because it really allows us to examine the thought process that one could go through, almost like the mental workflow of deciding how to take action. And it starts very aptly with consideration, being aware of the other people involved in a situation, whether they are present, whether they are a human or an entity, like a business, and just really thinking about how they are involved in this particular situation at hand and how they might be affected by it. And I think it's really important to consider everybody. And again, maybe those people aren't physical entities. Maybe they aren't present, but they might be impacted by it. So really expand your thinking for a moment and think about who's involved and how they're affected.
Other people's perspective matters.
Yeah.
How we behave impacts other people. And really starting from an awareness of that, a consideration of it, is a great place to start in its simplest form. If you had a worksheet in front of you, you could think of this as the part where you just make a list of the parties, the major players, the people that are involved in a situation. For the second step, we're going to think about some different ways that we might handle the situation. In the same way that you've generated in your mind a little list of all the different people that might be impacted, it's also, I think, important to give yourself a couple different options, a couple different ways that you might proceed, to remind yourself that you're in control, you get to decide, and that you give yourself options, that the beginning of making a choice comes from having a couple of different things that you might do. And you want to be explicit and clear with yourself that there are different ways you could approach something or handle it. And you want to give yourself a couple different ways to deal with a difficult situation, or even if it's not a difficult situation, a very human situation that you're engaged with and trying to figure out.
I love how you describe that, a human situation, because you're right. They're not all difficult, but you know, you still might have to run something through good old five-step process. Dan, can I tell the audience about one of my favorite things about this step?
Please.
Is that this step has such a therapeutic element to it, because you're in an imagination state. You're not actually doing these things. You're thinking about what might happen if you entertained these. And this is that space to entertain your bad self. This is that space to say, oh yeah, one of the options is I could tell this person right off. I could storm out of here. I could, you know, blow up the friendship bridge or whatever it is that we're doing. And I think that while definitely not something you're going to hear us suggest you lean into as a solution, it is a little bit fun or therapeutic, depending on the situation, to envision that thing that you might feel like doing, or that even the emotions inside of you might match, and yet tempering yourself, giving yourself the space to allow that to be a real thought. But when it's placed along a lot of those other solutions that might benefit more people involved, or that might just all the different solutions that you might have come up with, it deflates. And I find that as it deflates, when I compare it to the other solutions I've come up with, so does my emotion around it and my desire to engage it. And it's like a wonderful process of just kind of toning it down a little bit. Yes, I feel that way, but no, we're not going to go there. I love that moment of this particular state.
And I love your description of it as an imaginative process. I've never quite heard that before, but you're so right about it. And I think so often we make a lot of our decisions on a very instinctual level, or we use very habitual patterns of thought to decide how to proceed. And there's something about giving yourself permission to think about different solutions, and solutions that might be really good but a little too much, or solutions that might really not be great but are viable. They're part of the continuum of choices that you might make moving forward. And being able to explore those things, I think oftentimes is very illuminating. You say to yourself, boy, that's possible, but it's unrealistic. I'm never going to be able to do all that. Or, oh, that might feel good in the moment, but that's really just like a devastatingly bad choice for all these very obvious reasons. And
yes.
Something about being explicit, putting it on the table, makes it easier to not do that thing. I'm going to send the angriest email this client's ever heard in their life. I can't believe they talked to me that way. Mm-hmm. You know what? Not a lot of room there moving forward. Might feel good and is a choice that I know people make sometimes.
And once you've heard it, you can kind of de-escalate it, or it shows up so obviously as not the right idea, not the relationship builder.
Sometimes bad ideas are really useful, because they give us a sense of the parameters that we're operating in. If, as you say, we're approaching it as a creative or imaginative process, not something that, oh, no, we're going to do all of these things that we're thinking about, but we're really exploring options at this stage. Now it's time to evaluate those options. So let's actually start to put them to the test, shall we?
Bring the reality back in a little bit here from our imaginative state.
and the simplest version of this that I can think of is one where you put it to the relationship test. And I think about this part of the process as relating to respect. That if you fundamentally value other people, if you fundamentally respect other people and recognize their worth, that there is some benefit to maintaining that relationship in the best possible state that you can. And at the most ideal, if you have a set of solutions in front of you that are good, or the situation isn't so dire, that really grow or enhance the relationship. And sometimes a really good solution can take a really dire situation and turn it into an opportunity to grow or enhance a relationship. So the first decision-making criteria that we're going to apply to evaluating the different solutions in front of us is, Is it respectful? Does it grow the relationship? And I like to acknowledge that there are other valid reasons to make choices. You might decide that something is easier, quicker, faster, cheaper, more familiar. But I want to have the criteria and the assessment that is based on how it impacts the relationship, a potential choice, and the one that we're going to weight in this particular situation where we're thinking about this as etiquette problem solving or human relationship navigating with intentionality and a constructive focus.
Speaking of relationships, Dan, one of the things that I really love about this step where we're really evaluating the respect in the situation, you know, how respectful would these solutions be of the people? How would they impact the people around us? And when I look at those things and I'm thinking then about honesty, one of the things that I like that happens in here that I think etiquette often gets knocked for or that people assume is not a part of etiquette is the space in this step for self-respect.
Ding, ding, ding.
That you don't leave yourself out of the equation and that there are times where we're going to personally choose to take a hit instead of include ourselves in that, you know, the benefits of who's benefiting from the situation, who's it working out for. And there are choices we make. There are personal decisions. There are simple decisions that we make where we do that all the time. But we never want to leave out the option to consider our own perspective and what is going to uphold and serve our own sense of self-respect. And I think that it's another moment where I think etiquette wins because it really is looking at everybody and it really is asking you to think about everybody involved. The same way I find that thinking about how, you know, your company might be impacted by something that you do or that company is an entity you might not be thinking about it all the time. I love the moment where we also get to remind ourselves to be self-respectful in any solution that we come up with as best that we can.
Absolutely. Respect for others, respect for self, and respect for things, the traditions that support us, the systems that support us. There are lots of ways that we can apply respect, and it's a really good reminder that it's not always about an external focus for other people.
Yeah,
I think that respect is really useful for evaluating the potential solutions or the options that you've given yourself. Mm-hmm. When it comes time to make the choice, I like to connect that moment, the decision-making moment, to the idea of honesty.
Yeah.
And in my mind, it's both a standard of truth-telling, that it has to be something that is based on a shared reality that is truthful, that is honest, that we can recognize with each other as being coherent and consistent and true. But that there's also an element of authenticity and sincerity that's important. You talk about the ways that etiquette can not function well, the ideas that people can have about it that make it less useful. One of them being that it's always about respect for other people and not for yourself. Another trap that I think people fall into when they think about etiquette is that it's insincere, that it's about a set of standards that don't come from you, that aren't authentic, that are from some other time or place or person, that it's all about that external view. And that's just not true for me in the way I like to think about etiquette. I think ultimately behaviors only work, that the magic of magic words comes from your intent and how you use them. And that's the sincerity and the authenticity and the fact that it is a choice that you can make and honor and feel good about, at least in that it represents you the way you want to be represented. And if you've done the work of consideration and respect, I think it makes it much easier to make a choice that can be all of those things, whether it's an easy thing to execute or not. Mm-hmm. It can be a sincere choice. It can be an authentic choice. And hopefully it can also withstand the test of, is it true fundamentally? Are you being honest?
Yeah. Dan, you know me and our family. You've labeled me a rule breaker. We can't have a list of a procedure without also throwing in the option for some kind of caveat or adjustment or change up or fine tuning, as we like to call it. There might be something that you could do in addition to the solution that could maybe make the whole situation better for the other players involved or better for yourself. I always love it, Dan, in your seminars when you're using the example of someone, you know, you're at a business function and someone sneezed into the hand and your boss is just you know, brought you up to meet this person and they haven't wiped their hand off. You saw them sneeze into it and you are expected to shake that hand. And it is such an awkward moment. And, you know, the very selfish thing to do would be to not shake the hand and, you know, embarrass the client and probably, or confuse maybe and embarrass the client and the boss and all this. It would be such a squirmish hit to just shake the hand and have to just think about how gross that hand is the whole time that you're talking. And yet that's the solution, right? That allows the client to feel respected, the boss to feel proud of the employee and like expected norms were met. And you're the one losing out in that moment. Maybe, you know, you're doing well business wise, but your hand is clammy and gross. And I love the fine tuning of that moment, that right after that exchange is done, before I reach up and touch my face or anything, I will be excusing myself to the restroom to go wash my hand. And that the fine tuning gives you the confidence, knowing that you could do it afterwards, after the situation, gives you the confidence to like engage in that handshake well, even though you know it wasn't exactly your favorite option on the list, maybe.
My mother, Cindy Posetting, when she's talking to kids, often talks about searching for a kind truth as opposed to a harsh yes. or a brutal truth.
Yes.
What do you think of my new coat? Oh, it's just terrible. I can't believe you spent good money on it. True.
Not what I would have wanted.
That's going to keep you warm all winter. Also true, maybe a little bit more kind.
A little bit more kind. That is the other aspect to honesty. Yes.
And you and I could talk for a long time about the five-step process. We could get much more granular in our approach. And there are lots of tips and strategies and tactics for ways to engage each of the five steps in the process and to get more consistent and shareable results, or ways to talk about it with other people. But I think if you think about it, you can see some version of this happening with almost every question that we answer on this show that doesn't have a referenced answer, that there's usually some kind of thinking about who's involved and how they're impacted, and then a couple of different ways that you might be able to handle it, and then some kind of decision-making process about which of those solutions or which combination of those solutions works best together for everybody. And then hopefully some thinking about how you then, from where you're operating from, can deploy that kind of solution and what that actually looks and feels like and how it sounds coming from your mouth, or how those actions work when there's something that you've identified as something that you want to do or that you think is the good way to move forward.
And audience, we never get sick of doing this. So please keep sending us your questions so that we can run them through this process and explore them and hear your feedback for the angles we might have missed or forgotten or not considered, or that sounded terrible. You are so great about telling us how you see the etiquette in the solutions that we come up with. And I just love it. And I hope that you will continue to write in for years to come about the situations you experience and the questions that you have about them. So Dan, thank you so much for walking us through all of this. I envisioned you on stage the whole time you were doing it. And it was definitely fun. And I also just really appreciated the chance to expose new listeners to some of the method behind the madness. And we really hope again that everyone will send in their questions so that we can continue to look at them through the lens of consideration, respect, and honesty.
Everywhere you go, your manners are with you, and they leave their mark. They help you feel sure of yourself, too, and they make an impression on people, on everyone you meet. We could listen in on Jean's thoughts, for example, but well, you take it from here.
We like to end our show on a high note, so we turn to you to hear about the good etiquette you're seeing and experiencing out in the world. And that can come in so many forms. Today we have a salute from Holly.
Dear Lizzie and Dan, thank you for producing an entertaining and fun podcast to help us navigate the world with kindness, consideration, honesty, and respect. Big, big fan for many years. Oh, thank you. I have an etiquette salute I would like to submit for consideration. When traveling in Vienna this spring, my husband and I decided not to rent a car, and instead we chose to see the city via tram system, given its excellent reputation.
Upon setting out one morning, a number of locals were using the tram to commute to work and for the little ones to school. At one stop, a more senior woman entered the train. The train was only half full and there were plenty of empty seats, even though there was plenty of space for the woman. A young man who was about 12 years old still stood up and offered the woman his seat. My heart absolutely melted watching this little gentleman. I hope this story made you smile, and I give a hearty etiquette salute to the young men of Vienna. With warmest regards, melting in Austria. Oh, that is so sweet. It got me teary.
I heard that. Lizzie Bose.
I know. I was trying to not let it happen because I was like, Lizzie, you're crying over someone standing on the bus. But there was something about the way Melting in Austria wrote it that I was like, that is just lovely.
A moment of courtesy.
Thank you so much. A moment of courtesy. And an unneeded one. You know what I mean? That bus was half full. That is just such a lovely gesture. You're melting our hearts too.
Melting in Austria, I wanted to say. You are melting us just a little bit here in Vermont. Thank you so much for the salute.
Thank you for listening today.
And thank you to everyone who sent us something and everyone who supports us on Substack.
Please help us to grow the awesome etiquette community. Share this show with friends, family, and coworkers, however you like to share podcasts.
You can send us your next question, feedback, or salute by email to awesomeetiquette@emilypost.com. You can leave us a voicemail or text at 802-858-KIND. That's 802-858-5463. On Substack, you can leave your question on the Monday podcast post. On Instagram, we are at Emily Post Institute. And on Facebook, we are The Emily Post Institute.
Please consider becoming a member with a free subscription to our Substack at emilypost.substack.com. You can also subscribe to the ads version of our show on Spotify or your favorite podcast app, and please consider leaving us a review. It helps our show ranking, which will help more people to find awesome etiquette, and that is frankly just awesome.
Our show is edited by Chris Albertine and assistant produced by Bridget Dow.
Thanks, Chris and Bridget.